friends, this is Christine Hoover from GraceCoversMe.com, and surprise, it's a bonus episode of the By Faith podcast. I've extended the season on friendship by one episode. This episode is actually brought to you by Christian Audio, and it is the first three chapters of my book, the audio version, Messy, Beautiful Friendship. Enjoy this special New Year's surprise. Also, you'll want to know that Christian Audio is making the audio version of the entire book available to you for only $9.99 for the next week between January 1st and January 8th. So, as you are making your New Year's resolutions, I hope that you are thinking about being intentional with your friendships. And I hope that I can come along with you in the form of my audiobook to help you as you are intentional with friendship this year. Thanks, friends, for listening, and please enjoy these first three chapters of Messy, Beautiful Friendship. Many women privately wrestle with the complexities of adult friendship. Perhaps you are one of them. I certainly have struggled with friendship over the years. I've known years of friendship drought. I've experienced conflicts in relationships, some of my own making, that have tied my insights in knots. I've received wounds so bitter that I've retreated to cocoon myself in the false security of isolation. But I've also experienced deep relationships with other women that have enriched my life beyond measure, pointed me toward Christ, and challenged me to grow. These relationships have taught me that friendship is worth any struggle it takes to discover and deepen. No matter where your friendships currently are, you've probably found that your heart never ceases longing for fulfilling companionship. Friendship seems such a rarity to find and such a fragile joy when we found it, doesn't it? As I've let slip that I've been writing a book on friendship, the response has been something akin to thirst. Some in larger audiences have audibly squealed, not because they anticipate reading my words, but because they are bursting with need for relief from their private fears and struggles. In one small group setting, a woman practically jumped across the table at me, reaching, as it were, for help. She is one of many seeking an oasis in a desert. We want friends, all of us do, and not just any friends. We want relationships in which we know and are known at the deepest level. We want friendships that point us to grace and truth. Curiously, however, we seem to be standing beside one another, holding identical longings, yet resolutely believing we're alone in them. But the truth is, we aren't actually wandering alone and aimless in a desert. We're practically tripping over each other as we grasp at our ideal dreams for friendship. I've wondered at this. If we're alike in our desires, what keeps us from turning to our left and to our right to cultivate friendship with those around us? Well, it's not that simple, you might say, as you point to your failed attempts, your open wounds, the boxes you've just unpacked in a new community, your insecurities and assumptions, or your overextended schedule. Oh yes, I know all the reasons why it's not so simple, because I've given them myself, and I know all too well how quick we are to make those reasons into excuses, and those excuses into thick walls. My wall has historically been built upon the excuse that I'm a pastor's wife and women treat me differently because of it. I've rehearsed this excuse in my mind while simultaneously taking the do-nothing, hope-for-the-best approach to friendship. I have come to believe that our own excuses are one of our biggest obstacles to friendship, but I think there is one greater. We don't have an understanding of what true friendship is or how God designed it. In the void, we've taken up a cultural definition that makes friendship unattainably idyllic and about self. Who is doing what for me? How do other people make me feel? Who is reaching out to me or including me? Who is honoring me? Without a biblical understanding of friendship, we tend toward believing we're unique and that everyone else must mold themselves around our personalities, our needs, and our schedules. As a result, we continually aspire to ideal friendship that is easy, comfortable, fun, and initiated by others. Perhaps this explains why we perpetually thirst in a desert. As Christians, we must look to the Bible to inform our friendships. In this book you hold in your hands, we will look together to God in His Word for our definition and practice of friendship. Spoiler alert, we'll find that friendship is a byproduct of being more concerned with others than ourselves. Hopefully, you've picked up this book because you want deep friendships, and you're done with the excuses you've erected into walls of isolation. Perhaps you've been frustrated, discouraged, or disappointed by the realities of friendship, and you need some help re-engaging broken relationships or fostering new ones. Good. You're who I wrote this book for. Christian women who need a fresh perspective on friendship, who need to know that they're not alone in their wrestling, and who want to know how to navigate relationships in a way that honors God. Together, we'll shatter idealistic and unattainable dreams of friendship, embrace God-designed friendship, name threats to godly friendship, discover the means we have at our disposal to find and deepen friendship, learn what it takes to be a good friend, and learn how to receive the friendship of others. I pray you'll find what I have discovered in my own life. Friendship is messy, but even in its messiness, it is beautiful indeed. Chapter 1. When did friendship become such a struggle? It is not simply to be taken for granted that the Christian has the privilege of living among other Christians. Dietrich Bonhoeffer. When we were children, friendship merely happened to us. Friends came as easily as the sunrise and as effortlessly as the line on the doorframe by which we measured ourselves inch taller every year. We didn't have to think about making friends. We simply approached the monkey bars on the playground, signed up for an after-school team, or steered our bikes into the neighborhood sidewalks, and within seconds we were swept up in a swarm of similarly aged kids barreling toward the ice cream truck, blaring circus music on loop. We were racing alongside our teammates to the concession stand for after-game snow cones, or migrating together through the neighborhood in gangs of three-wheelers, scooters, and Schwinns. Our mothers, when probing for the day's details, referred to this random assortment of kids as our friends, and we supposed they actually were, because they generally liked what we liked, lived where we lived, and did what we did. They were in our proximity, moving in the same kid orbit. Therefore, they were our friends. My grade school best friend lived around the corner from me in a house that smelled of stale cigarettes. On sticky summer days, we'd lie on our stomachs on her brown and white speckled shag carpet, chins propped on our fists and feet thrust in the air, watching people get slimed on Nickelodeon, a channel I didn't get at home. She had a white canopy bed with high posters, which we'd use as microphones to belt out Whitney Houston songs as we jumped around on her bedspread. Famished from these rock star demands, we'd run to the kitchen for oatmeal cream pies, and afterwards she'd teach me ballet positions using the oven handle as our bar. We had little in common aside from being in the same class at school and living on the same street, and our childlike friendship required little to no work on my part, aside from the bike pedaling or roller skating it took to make my way over to her house. Few responsibilities limited our time together, few insecurities existed between us despite our differences, and little thought was given to where we stood with each other. We just were. High school and college friendships. My family and I moved away from that street and that city entirely the summer between elementary school and middle school, that period of time that is the exact intersection of growing social awareness and self-conscious awkwardness. I cried my eyes out to my mom my entire sixth grade year because I was the perpetual new kid. I didn't like being the new kid, and most painfully of all, I was struggling to make new friends. It was the first time I'd ever felt out of place, and being brutally shy, I was suddenly faced with the realization that I'd actually have to try in order to have friends. Merely joining a softball team or the youth group at our new church wasn't going to cut it. I'd probably have to speak to people as well. Finally, after about a year, I fell into a group of girls who were part of my youth group: Joe, Sarah, Cindy, Ashley, and eventually Anne. It was Joe, however, who became my closest friend. Joe knew when I liked a boy, and I knew when she liked a boy, and blessedly we never liked the same ones. In middle and high school, not liking the same boys is absolutely the key to an enduring friendship, and so ours lasted. Together, we laid out in the summers, exercised to Jane Fonda aerobic videos, marched in the high school band, and slumber partied at each other's houses, where we'd fall asleep listening to tapes of the New Kids on the Block. Our friendship was comfortable, easy, and a warm, reassuring blanket during our high school years. Knowing I always had Joe, no matter what, gave me a sort of confidence that exceeded my average teenage insecurities. Then came college. She chose one, and I chose another, and we made plans as to how we'd stay connected. Our Sunday school teacher, with good intentions, I'm sure, tried to prepare us for an evolving friendship, predicting that we probably wouldn't remain best friends. With that gauntlet thrown down, we entrenched ourselves even further in our dedication to call and write each week. Our mutual friend Nancy, who sat behind me in calculus class and constantly sprayed breath freshener into her mouth, informed me of something that might make communication easier, this thing called email. "Oh no," I said snidely, "I'm sure that's not something I'll ever use." Shockingly, we did use email, and the phone, and the answering machine, and old-fashioned letters. But mostly email, just as Fresh Breath Nancy said we would. We weren't in close proximity anymore, and our friendship required more work than it ever had, but I'd learned that friendship isn't always guaranteed. Making friends takes effort. Time together helps. Being in each other's home solidifies friendship, and I would have to let a friendship evolve in order for it to survive. College is where I delve deeper into the distinctive joy and richness of Christian friendship. My freshman year, I joined a Christian sorority made up of 300 girls who held me accountable and asked me about my walk and wanted to do life with me. And did I mention that we had a counterpart Christian fraternity? I met my husband through that fraternity, and we were elected presidents of our respective groups at the same time. I'm not joking. We each had red presidential phones, hotlines that allowed us to call each other with Christian emergencies. Okay, I'm joking about that one. Christian community in college, I discovered, required a new kind of vulnerability. In high school, vulnerability was revealing the name of the boy you had a crush on. In college, however, there was the whole aforementioned accountability thing. People wanted to know stuff so they could pray for you. You listened to their stuff so you could pray for them. This was Christian friendship in college, cemented by intense time together, proximity, and lots of fun. I found it incredibly fun to live with and among my friends and to stay up past midnight talking and laughing and even praying together. I enjoyed having a full social calendar and meeting hundreds of new and interesting people. And Mom and Dad, I also had a full academic calendar of studying, going to the library, getting 8 hours of sleep each night, reading every assigned reading, and going to class. Yep, so full. P.S. Thanks for college. I learned a ton that I continue to use to this day. And then we became adults. Looking back, college was the friendship jackpot. I remember that time with fondness, and I admit that I've spent much of my adulthood dreaming up ways to recreate that slice of life. College friendships felt much like my childhood friendships, when community just sort of happened to me, except in college it was with additional freedom, opportunities, and diversity in the types of friends I made. Everyone was on an equal playing field because everyone started as a new student, and everyone was asking the same questions about life and the future and relationships. But then we all became adults. Suddenly, we weren't on an equal playing field any longer, because some of us became engineers and some of us chose to get a graduate degree in psychology. Some of the kids I went to high school with had skipped college altogether, entering the workforce straight out of high school and having to grow up a little quicker. Some of us got married right away and some of us didn't. Some of us were already picking out fabric swatches for the curtains and couches in our newly purchased house, while the rest of us went back to Mom and Dad's spare bedroom. I moved into an apartment with Joe, who'd also graduated that May, and before we had even finished arranging the living room furniture, she was blissfully and ecstatically engaged to the boy she'd giggled about through the computer back in college. Our boxes weren't even unpacked, and she was already announcing that she'd be moving out in mere months. I was feeling less than blissful and ecstatic because it felt like he was becoming her best friend and little single old me was being left in the dust. I didn't like that my friendships were evolving, nor did I find this new social territory exciting. Life coaxed me toward making new friends, but I didn't want to make new friends. I simply wanted to figure out how to maintain the ones I already had. I wanted things to be how they used to be. Effortless, carefree, fun. In reality, I had crossed over some invisible line. I was no longer a child, and friendship had become inexplicably and frustratingly hard. The ease of childhood friendship was forever irretrievable. Becoming an adult did a number on our friendships, did it not? At least that's what I've observed in my own life and what I've heard from other women along the way. Transitioning into life as an adult tilted our equilibrium in a way that took us years to recover from, if we've ever recovered at all. Finding and learning a new job, finding and learning a new city, finding and learning a new church, figuring out the whole singleness thing or the marriage and kids thing, all of these have demanded our best efforts and prime energy. Friendship? We've had to coast a little bit on what we built long ago, and over time, all that coasting has ended in loneliness or attempts at recreating youthful friendships or painful heartache and anguish. The ease and the confidence we'd grown up with regarding our ability to make and deepen friendships quietly eroded. The time we'd always enjoyed to make and deepen friendships evaporated into work and diapers. Somehow, friendship became a struggle. And I didn't have the foggiest clue how to cultivate adult friendships. They seemed a different creature altogether, and they definitely would require work and effort. I could tell that the second I crossed the invisible line into adulthood. But just how was I going to do this? How did one make new friends and spend time with old ones while also juggling so many responsibilities and obligations? Inching along in traffic every day as I commuted to my first post-college job, I thought about the adult friendships I'd observed growing up, searching for clues. Honestly, there weren't many friendships I could recall, and that should have been my very first clue. But there was one. When I was a child, my parents constantly lugged my sister and me across town to Kay and Kenny's house. There, we played with their son, ate simple meals, and ran wildly through the mishmash of yards in their home's vicinity, while our parents talked or played cards. I don't remember not knowing Kay and Kenny. They'd been my parents' friends since before my birth. When my family moved across Texas that summer before I started middle school, Kay and Kenny actually moved with us. When Kay and Kenny built a house on a cul-de-sac, we built a house right across the street. When their son got his driver's license, he became my ride to and from school each day. Even when the three of us kids were teenagers and all going our separate directions, we still occasionally had hamburgers on Kay and Kenny's back porch, and we still went to the lake together each summer. Even then, the summer after college, which I spent sitting in Dallas traffic when I'd go home to visit, soon after I pulled into the driveway, Kay and Kenny would come across the street with a meal or an invitation for dessert on their back porch, as if their own child had come home. Their friendship with my parents had taken purposefulness. They'd made decisions that stoked the friendship and kept it alive. These decisions weren't necessarily as big as the one to move to the same city at the same time, although that certainly helped, but rather smaller ones, to pop into each other's homes for a few minutes of conversation, to serve at church together, to champion each other's children. Their friendship had also taken perseverance. They didn't quit on each other, despite being fairly different and despite their children being fairly different. And it had taken time. Their friendship had been built over many years, not a few months. Like with a good wine, time had aged the friendship well. As a fledgling grown-up searching for clues about adult friendship, I knew instinctively that this kind of friendship was rare, and thinking about it for the first time, I treasured that my parents had cultivated such a thing, and that, simply by proximity and osmosis, I'd had it too. I'd had the picnics on the back deck thrown together at the last minute, and the spontaneous decisions to go out to eat, all of us piling intermixed into cars. We just walked into their house, and they just walked into ours, bringing or borrowing whatever was needed. And if we were lucky, the meal ended with Kenny's famous homemade ice cream, the kind that is half-melted from the start and requires a second or third helping. On the back door of the house where Kay and Kenny lived when I was young, hung a sign that read, "Backdoor friends are best." That's what I hoped for myself, backdoor friends. Women who felt comfortable waltzing in my door without knocking, who grabbed what they needed from my fridge without asking permission, who knew that there was a seat at the table and love in my heart for them, and who knew that the meal just might end with homemade ice cream. And so, with those clues and hopes and ideals in my head, I set out to get that kind of adult friendship. Chapter 2, The Dreams We Have for Friendship. Christian brotherhood is not an ideal which we must realize. It is rather a reality created by God in Christ in which we may participate. Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Yesterday, I heard a classic Journey song on the radio, the one about bright lights, life on the road, and intense pining for a love waiting at home. "I'm forever yours, faithfully." In high school, when Joe and I traveled with the marching band to away football games, I listened to that song over and over again on my Walkman, dreaming of the time when I'd finally have a love to call my own. I suppose I thought at the time that I was living a hard life on the road, traveling to play my flute because our football team needed rallying, and that somewhere someone was faithfully waiting for me to high step into the stadium of his heart. When I heard the song yesterday, I was driving my mom car to pick up my kids at school for the bazillionth day in a row. I'd spent the morning doing laundry and dishes, making copies for a meeting I was leading at church on Sunday, responding to emails, cleaning toilets to prepare for hosting small group, and briefly talking to my husband on the phone in order to discuss car repairs. In other words, an enviously sexy morning. So sexy, I'd forgotten to eat breakfast, and food is not something I ever forget to do. Rather than a romantic music video, I instead seem to be auditioning for a Saturday Night Live sketch about mom jeans. Those first few keyboard notes have faithfully hit my speakers, however, and I was transported back, not to high school, not to the constricting feeling of those polyester band pants and my pretend music videos, but to a deep sense of longing. I longed again for what I dreamed of in high school, an all-encompassing, undistracted love. I longed in that moment to escape my life and my responsibilities, even for a few short hours, and be enveloped by a romantic escapade with my husband. Not only that, and I knew this was asking a lot, but I really wanted that time with my husband to be free of car repair decisions. I wanted the rapturous, the romantic, the music video, minus the mullets, kind of love. Instead, I sat in the carpool line and then oh so rapturously made spaghetti for dinner. I've been married for 17 years. I know from experience that the romantic ideal of love is a cloud of smoke that dissipates quickly. However, I know what long-standing, everyday love is, and I know that it is so much better than anything Journey ever made me believe. But sometimes, especially when I'm knee-deep in the routines and obligations of life, the fantasy beckons loudly and seems to be of greater glory than reality, and I have to remind myself that to hold on to a dream is to miss the beauty of real love. In other words, I tend toward thinking that the ideal is still the dream, even though I know it's not the dream. God began shattering my romanticized, me-centered dream of marriage on our honeymoon, but there was another romanticized dream I held tightly to my chest for much longer into my adult life, friendship. The dream I'd set out to get, born in rush hour traffic on I-75 during a summer of discontent and grief over all that had changed, backstopped by easy childhood and college friendships. It became a longing. I longed for ideal friendship and earnestly believed it was possible. It was a longing for what I imagined friendship could be, what I hoped it would be, and I clutched it for years, unwilling to release it, convinced everyone had it but me. The search for the one true friend to rule them all. Let's fast forward from my first year out of college when I was figuring out life in the real world. I got married a few years later, and a year into our marriage, my husband Kyle accepted a church staff position in the town where we'd attended college. So we moved, bought a house, and a few years after that had the first of our three children. My college friends were scattered, Joe and her husband had moved across the country, and I was left trying to form adult friendships in the town I'd known only as a college student. I didn't try very hard, if you want to know the truth. We lived in that town for 7 years, and those were some of the loneliest years of my life. I'm not sure I had a single friend, at least not one I felt comfortable calling to take care of my kids if I came down with anything more serious than a cold. That was my litmus test. Who would I call in an emergency? Who would I call if I needed something? The answer was a shrug, which always elicited a pang in my heart. Friendship, or the lack thereof, became a source of insecurity, pain, and even shame because it was so starkly different from what it had been in other periods of my life. Somewhere along the way, I figured, I'd lost the ability to make friends. I felt as if I was moving backward, as if I was forgetting important things I'd felt so sure about for most of my life. Before you began feeling sorry for me, or probably more so wanting to punch me in my whiny, self-pitying face, I readily admit that my loneliness was all my fault. I can see it all so clearly now, although at the time I couldn't see any of it. I couldn't see that I was too much inside myself and frustrated that people didn't pursue me. I couldn't see that my response to the frustration, isolating myself physically and emotionally and rarely pursuing anyone was hurting me further. I didn't notice how, when people would ask me to do this or that, I'd say no because it didn't fit into my nice, neat little box of time and interest and ease. One woman I remember would ask me to join her and her friend for lunch while my son was at Mother's Day out, and I rejected the invitation over and over because I had errands to run. Errands, for crying out loud. I didn't take into account how very rarely I asked anyone to lunch or coffee or over to our house. I didn't see how, when I actually did reach out to people, I kept things very much on the surface because I was afraid to be vulnerable with people. Throughout those years, there were sputtering starts, and when things didn't immediately blossom into deep friendship, abrupt stops. I didn't ask for help, I didn't lean on anyone, and I didn't let anyone see me sweat. I don't know why I behaved that way. It went against everything I'd learned in my formative friendships about time and hospitality and vulnerability. Friendship became something that elicited shame, but at the same time, I craved it with journey-like intensity. I couldn't find words for it, but I often found myself in tears. Only my husband saw my tears, and most of them in those years were related to friendship. Really, I was insecure and nervous and arrogant. Because now that I can look back at those years with matured vision, I recognize that I actually had seedling friendships during the very times I was in tears over my want. I couldn't name my friends then because I couldn't see them, but I can name them now. Ashley and Jamie and Nikki and Kelly. Ashley and I had a raw conversation about our children at the pool one day that swung wide the door for friendship. Jamie and I had a standing playdate. Nikki offered me encouragement when I needed it, and Kelly was always so easy to be with. But I wasn't satisfied, to be honest. I wanted something more while at the same time doing nothing to have more. I can also now understand why I couldn't see those friendships for the gifts they were, because my vision was blurred by my romanticized, idealistic standard of that one true friend to rule them all. My own dream, though it seemed beautiful and attainable, was actually piercing me through. My dream, by its very nature, held prerequisite stipulations. My one true friend needed to live in my town, attend my church, be married and have children, have a husband who my husband liked, and be a friend who empathetically understood the demands ministry placed upon us. My friendships were the equivalent of Jerry's dating rotation on Seinfeld. I rejected perfectly good seedling relationships because of ridiculous and petty details such as man hands, or in my case, age, marital status, or a so-so conversation. Can I tell you, as I look back at that time, what I so clearly see now? In my desire to have good friends, I'd simply traded one immature perspective of friendship from my childhood, that friendship would simply happen to me, for another, that the perfect friendship was actually attainable. The wish dream. Perfect and easy friendship seems to be the last to die dream for many women. We see through the smoke of romantic love fairly early. We learn quickly that chasing beauty or money or perfection is like grasping for the wind. But we hold oh so tightly to our ideal dream of friendship. Dietrich Bonhoeffer calls this our wish dream. In his book, Life Together, he says we all have wish dreams about life in Christian community. The serious Christian set down for the first time in a Christian community is likely to bring with him a very definite idea of what Christian life together should be and to try to realize it. We must be aware of the desires we attach to Christian friendship, he says, because in Christian brotherhood, everything depends upon its being clear right from the beginning. First, that Christian brotherhood is not an ideal, but a divine reality. Unfortunately, we Christians seem to be the most stubborn purveyors of the wish dream because it sounds biblical to pursue idealistic unity and community. Friendship doesn't happen according to our dream world, however. It's not linear or static or formulaic. Friendship is formed between imperfect people among the concrete and messy realities of life. Biblical friendship is distinct in that it brings the grace, forgiveness, and truth of Jesus into those messy realities, but it is messy nevertheless. Just as marital love is forged in the daily acts of care and selflessness and mundane responsibilities, friendship is formed in real life, sin, suffering, conflict, and all. Bonhoeffer seems to be saying to us that friendship is a good and right desire, but it is only able to be given and received as God intended it to be given and received. And he deals in reality rather than a dream world. We aren't asked to give up our desire for friendship, only the immature version of it, that all will be hippy-skippy perfect, that relationships will be forever fun and easy, that we can sit back and wait for others to come toward us, and that all of our needs will be met through other people. We need only become aware of the wish dream and we'll suddenly see it writing itself all over our hearts. That's why I can look back and see those years so clearly, because now I know about the wish dream. I recently gathered together some of my friends from all different ages and stages, and asked them about their own perspectives on friendship. Their wish dreams immediately came to the surface. Lacey, an aspect of friendship that I have longed for and struggled to find, or know if I already have it, maybe I have it but I don't realize it, is that friend who just knows. Or that friend who, if something really crazy happened with my kids or at home, would be that first friend I call. I've thought about that before. A lot of times I haven't known who that is. Maybe I do have that friend, but maybe I've idealized who that person should be, so I don't recognize who those people are in my life. Susan, I think we sometimes still think like children. It should be easy. It should be one person, and this person is going to be everything to me. And it hasn't turned out to be that way. Friendships take a ton of work. Mary Lynn, for me, it's not just wondering who I'm going to call, but wondering who's going to call me. And I want that to be the same person. So often the person who calls me isn't the person I'm going to call. Kate, there was a stage when we lived with another married couple. I remember thinking it would be awesome. We'll cook dinner together and go grocery shopping together. It's going to be like we're in college with roommates, but we're married. This is going to be wonderful. Let's live in community together. Week two, I thought, I don't know if God really called me to this community. We had to push through raw pain and conflict. I wanted to quit almost every month. As women, we want to quit when it gets hard. We think, this isn't easy, so maybe I misinterpreted it. For that period in my life, it was obvious that God called me to that friendship. He made it apparent and clear. That didn't make it easy. Amy D., part of my wish dream is that I wish I could be the perfect friend. Melanie, too often I think, oh, I want her to be my friend because we would have so much in common, even if her is someone who isn't really available to friendship, so to speak. It is also true that sometimes I don't think of people as friends who really are because they are a coworker or older or younger. I definitely have an ideal friendship in my mind, the relationship I had with my best friend in high school. That is sort of the relationship I apply the word friend to, but it isn't a practical type of relationship for most women. So maybe I need to be more generous with the label friend. Emma, I think we all desire a comfy, closed circle with our BFFs, with no one who's hard to love or who doesn't fit in. I think we often have unrealistic expectations for friendships. Wish dreams hinder real friendship. I see myself in their words. I see how I've pierced myself through with my own wish dream, all because I've dealt in idealism rather than reality. Do you see the wish dream in your own heart? Take note of its shape and be quick to release it, because the wish dream is not inconsequential. It is a hindrance to real friendship. When we hold an ideal of friendship in our minds, believing it's attainable, we hold a standard above the heads of real women God has placed in our lives, and then we wonder why we're constantly disappointed by the realities, complexities, and difficulties in our relationships. That was me. In the season of life when I had few friends, my wish dream fed my disappointment with myself and with others, but primarily with God. It appeared to me that everyone around me had friends. Therefore, I concluded God was withholding a good gift from me for no apparent reason. Even now that I am all too aware of my tendency toward idealizing friendship and what I think it should be, my wish dreams resurrect themselves. I want to keep friendship static. I don't want people to move or change or make decisions that hinder us from getting together. I am a mother hen trying desperately to gather my friends in a little cozy cage and keep them there forever. Lovingly, of course. I want the sugary, sweet, easy-come community where we flit into one another's homes without knocking, laugh deep into the night, know one another and are known without effort, and never exchanged a cross or challenging word. I typically envision dinner parties and game nights, vacationing together and talking on the phone every day. It seems this is a common idea of what Christian community should be. It seems that to let it go is to let go of a right and good dream, a biblical dream of unity and community. But in reality, our wish dreams have little to do with God and His kingdom and everything to do with us and ours. God gives us relationships that are enjoyable and a blessing, but also sanctify and challenge us out of our selfishness because He intends to get the glory from our friendships. Our wish dreams encourage us to seek our own glory and satisfaction in friendships that are safe, easy, comfortable, and self-serving. I want the dinner parties and the game nights and the vacations and every cozy scenario I can think of because I want to feel a sense of security and belonging in this world. And I don't necessarily want to have to sacrifice, serve, and love without being served and loved in return. I want the Instagram picture of friendship, not the three-dimensional real-life kind. Although my wish dream appears beautiful, I tell myself it's like a puff of cotton candy that disappears on my tongue. As long as I feed the dream, I will be left with just a film of disappointment and dissatisfaction. Our wish dreams must die a painful death so that we can get on with real-life friendship. Wish dreams don't want to be reminded of real life, where friendship takes effort, and there is precious little time, and responsibilities often come first, and physical distance exists. Wish dreams don't envision the faithful wounds of a friend, or walking with them through death or mental illness. No, wish dreams reach forward or reach back for anything that's not reality, prettying it all up, romanticizing it like a journey song, and making it all seem maddeningly attainable. Consequences of wish dreams. If we do not shatter our wish dreams of friendship, God, in His grace, always will. He desires to give us true biblical friendship, and it all hangs on how we respond when our romanticized view of friendship is trampled on. Will we look inward with a critical eye, blaming ourselves? Will we look outward with judgment and frustration, blaming those around us for their insensitivity and callousness? Will we give God the stink eye until He gives the good gift He appears to be withholding from us? Will we hold tightly to the shattered pieces of our dreams and either try to piece them back together or bemoan in isolation what we clutch in our hands? Will we allow our shattered wish dreams to feed our insecurities, comparison, and bitterness and keep us from using our gifts to serve others? Bonhoeffer says these are the natural consequences of the wish dream. The man who fashions a visionary ideal of community demands that it be realized by God, by others, and by himself. He enters the community of Christians with his demands, sets up his own law, and judges the brethren and God himself accordingly. When things do not go his way, he calls the effort a failure. So he becomes first an accuser of his brethren, then an accuser of God, and finally, the despairing accuser of himself. When I first read those words, they pierced me to the heart. They encapsulated the years stretching from college to when I had three small children underfoot. They helped me to finally see why friendship had been so difficult, because I had made it about me and my own personalized vision of what I wanted it to look like. Over and over and over again, I'd tried to piece together a wish dream God had shattered. And so I learned a vital lesson that has served me far more than any others I'd picked up in my formative years. True friendship is mapped out by God, and it is for Him. A rich opportunity for friendship exists when we reject the ideal wish dream, understand God's design for friendship, and embrace those imperfect women who are right in front of us. This perspective wiped my slate clean, freeing me from my childish and selfish perspective. But it was put to the test soon after. After 7 years in that city where I had so struggled, we moved to a different state because of a new ministry calling, and I made a conscious choice that I wouldn't pack my wish dream along with the baby crib and the china. God was giving me a friendship do-over, and I determined to learn from my false starts, mistakes, and all those seedling friendships I'd never truly watered. 8 years after that move, I am still no expert. In fact, I've made a mess of some of my relationships, and I'm still not always sure about myself when it comes to friendship. But I no longer romanticize it. My apologies to Journey, but I have stopped believing in the cotton candy dream. I can say, as someone who has left the shattered wish dream shattered, that there is a way to cultivate beautiful, real-life friendships, messiness and all. Remember what Bonhoeffer said? Christian brotherhood is not an ideal, but it is a divine reality. It starts there.
I hope you enjoyed this little preview of the audio version of Messy Beautiful Friendship. Remember that Christian Audio is having a sale on the audio version of the book. I've put a link in the show notes so you can find it easily. And you can get the book for only $9.99 for the next week between January 1st and January 8th. Happy New Year, friends!